Maybe it's cheaper, you can just shut the door. Thanks. Okay, so today's going to be the last lecture that I'm going to give on operational quantum mechanics. It's going to start by talking about more general kinds of transformations besides just unitaries. I realize that it's just so beautiful that I kind of have to tell you about it. So you've heard a bit about it from in Ben Schumacher's course, and I'm going to give it to you from the operationalist perspective. And then the second half of the lecture will be a bit about axiomatics, how this framework gives you a way of starting to talk about principles from which you can derive quantum theory. And then tomorrow's lecture is going to be given by Lucien Hardy, and he's done a lot of research on axiomatizations of quantum theory, and he's going to be telling you about some of that work. So this is also preparatory material for Lucien's lecture tomorrow. And then next week, we're going to move on to realism and hidden variable models and lots of other topics. So are there any questions from last time and the stuff we've covered so far on density operators, POVMs? Is that clear? Everyone's happy with that? Good. All right, so here's where we're at. We started with this formulation where the preparation is represented by vectors, measurements by projection-valued measures, transformations by unitaries, and the probabilities of outcomes were given by this formula here. And we've talked about why we need to consider more general representations of preparations. There are preparations that are associated with density operators, which are positive trace one operators, and measurements that are associated with positive operator valued measures rather than projection valued measures. And so the question is, what other transformations are there besides unitary maps? So I'll start by asking you, can you come up with a transformation that clearly can't be represented by a unitary? Yang? Something that's not invertible. OK. Can you be more explicit?
Like just like the POVM, so half the time you do
right, exactly. And so, a weighted mixture of different unitaries itself can't be represented by some other unitary. Yes? Other examples?
Any evolution of a pure state into a mixed state?
Any evolution of a pure state into a mixed state? Yes? Now, that won't be represented by a unitary. And so I'm wondering, what can you set up in the lab that will guarantee that a pure state, at least some pure state, evolves to a mixed state? What kinds of setups will do that? Yes? On the right track with the composite system.
Yeah, I know what Trevor was saying, I'm just having trouble saying.
But while you're formulating your thoughts, let me take someone at the back.
It's like decohering with the environment because of temperature or just because of the particles in the environment.
Right, so you said decohering with the environment, but you could have equally well said just interacting with an environment. If you have a system, it interacts with the environment, and that environment is carrying information about the system away from it. At the end of the day, your characterization of the system, you no longer have perfect predictability about the system. So there's no measurements that are perfectly predictable anymore. And that's why it's not represented by a pure state anymore. A pure state, there's always some measurement that's perfectly predictable. So yeah, that's a huge class of interactions, a huge class of transformations that aren't represented by unitaries. And just as I was saying, that the POVMs are really the generic way of representing a measurement, and a projection-valued measure is an idealization that's never actually realized in the lab. Similarly, it's extremely difficult to truly isolate a system in your lab, make sure that it's really not interacting with any elements of the environment. There's some papers on decoherence which talk about, what's the effect of cosmic rays. You know, the cosmic rays will come in and interact with your system and carry away some information about where it's located, for example. So there's sort of very low levels of interaction with the environment that are extremely hard to isolate against. So the generic situation is a non-unitary map. I have in mind one other example, which is a tricky one. So I wonder so what I'm looking for is something you could do, which, you know, it doesn't yield an outcome, so it's a deterministic, right? It maps some density operator to another density operator. It's not described by a unitary. So anybody else? We've covered a large class of them now, but there's another one that is talked about frequently, so I'm curious if anyone can think what it is. Yes? Well, typically when you interact with an environment, you're kind of throwing away the environment in a sense. But actually, I mean, you bring up a good point that, you know, I've been asking here specifically for transformations that take you from a given Hilbert space to the same Hilbert space. But a more general class of transformations are ones which you start, the input space is one Hilbert space and the output space is a different Hilbert space. So if I just if I start with a composite system and discard one of its pieces, I can also describe that by a map, but it's not an automorphism anymore. So yeah, we could have a more general discussion about maps like that. There are maps where you add systems in, and that's another way of doing it. That's a good point. It's not the one I had in mind, though. So I'm still, there's one other nice example of a transformation from a given Hilbert space to the same Hilbert space that's not a unitary. Going once? No? Okay. Well, the example I had in mind is, suppose that inside that black box, what's happening is a measurement, and the system survives the measurement, but the outcome of the measurement is not communicated outside the black box. So if it's a projective measurement, then we know that we should apply our projection postulate, but now we just sum over all the outcomes because we don't know which ones occurred. And that is going to be some transformation. It'll take density operators in, and density operators will come out. And generally what it'll do is it'll destroy coherence between the different states that are being measured in that measurement. So all of those are examples of transformations that aren't represented by unitaries. And so I'm going to quickly go through how you represent each of those. Sure. Yes?
Could the example of an entangled state where we measure one of the states but don't reveal the answer?
Yep.
Would be an example of that?
Yeah, exactly. You could couple it to an ancilla, measure the ancilla, not register the outcome. And then from the perspective of somebody on the outside, they have to say, well, a kind of measurement has occurred, but I don't know the outcome, so there's nothing probabilistic about that transformation. It's not as if it goes to many different possible states. It goes to the average of the output states. Okay, so here was the first example, mixture of unitaries. So the story is going to be very familiar by now. How do we figure out what's the effect of transformation associated with this? Well, we just say, suppose that I proceed it with some preparation, and I succeed it by some POVM measurement, and then I ask what are the probabilities of the outcomes k, and they're just going to be given by the probability of getting k given that the unitary number I was performed times the probability that the unitary I was in fact performed summed over all I. And again, we know what P of k given I is. That's just you know, what I had on a couple of slides ago. It's just take rho, transform it by ui, and take the trace with ek. So I weight these terms with probabilities pi, and then I note that this being a scalar can be moved inside the trace, the sum over I can be moved inside the trace, and so I take rho, I transform it with this operation, and I trace with ek. So the answer is that the map T associated with this overall box is just given by a sum over pi of the unitary I. So sort of the obvious answer. The second example was one where you interact with another system, which is often an environment, if we're talking about decoherence, or in quantum information theory, people often call this the ancilla system. So the idea is that I prepare the ancilla in some arbitrary state, I unitarily couple it to my system, and then I throw away the ancilla. I basically ignore it. I don't do any measurement on it. And the question is, what is the map associated with that overall box? Same trick. I now say, let's throw in an arbitrary state on the system's Hilbert space and do a measurement on the system's Hilbert space at the end of the day. If you ask, what's the probability of getting outcome k? We know the answer to that. It's, you know, take the initial state, rho s, tensor tau a. Apply the unitary on the composite system, s and a. That'll give you some new state over the composite s and a. And then ask, what's the probability of getting outcome k in this measurement? So it's a trivial measurement on the ancilla. You don't look at it at all. So I represent that by identity. And this measurement here on the system. And I have to trace over the whole composite system. And then I can just rearrange things. I can move the trace over A inside through this operator on S. And this whole term now is on the inside, it's some operator on SA, but I'm tracing over A. So the whole thing's going to be an operator on S. And because this is a density operator, and a unitary acting on a density operator gives me another density operator. And furthermore, if I take the partial trace of a valid density operator on the composite, I get a reduced density operator. So this whole thing is a density operator on the system S. And so the map I'm looking for takes the original density operator on S to T of rho S defined as follows. So that's kind of complicated. There are simpler ways of expressing that, which I'll get to in a minute. But that's the basic idea. OK, and then the this is what you saw a lot of in Ben's course. I think he spent a lot more time on open system dynamics. And so all open system dynamics are of this form. They entangle a system with the environment, and they see what the effective evolution of the system is. Here I've been just talking about discrete evolutions, you know, over a certain period of time. But you can also come up with a master equation, which is a differential equation that tells you precisely how a state changes continuously over time when it's interacting with the environment. And I'm not going to talk about that, but it was part of Ben's course. Okay, finally, the third example is you have some overall black box. Inside it is a measurement device. For simplicity, let me assume it's a projective measurement, and the update is according to the von Neumann collapse rule. And the outcome of this measurement is not communicated outside the black box. So from somebody on the outside, all they know is that there's this measurement going on, but they don't know which outcome occurs. Okay, so it's a bit tricky to see how this is going to update density operators. So let me go through it. If we put into this green box here just the state psi, then the collapse postulate would say that the final state is just the projection pi k of psi normalized. And so this is some final state psi k. And the different final states occur with probability given by the expectation value of pi k for the state psi. So that's just the standard collapse rule. Now, suppose I express this in terms of density operators. So I just take the outer product of psi with itself. Well, then I just take the outer product of the final state with itself. And this is what it looks like. And now I want to know, what happens if I put in a density operator rho? How does it update under this kind of operation? So here's the subtlety. It's not just a mixture of these final states. So imagine you take psi I now as your input, and you project it out with pi k. You don't just sum over the probabilities of the different i's, because you've registered an outcome k. And that might give you some new information about which of these psi i's was prepared prior to this measurement. So for example, certain outcomes k might be orthogonal to certain psi I, so you know definitely the input wasn't that psi I. So you wouldn't want to add that final state in your final mixture, because you know that it wasn't one of those states. So what you do instead is you say, I update my information about what the input state was based on the outcome I've gotten. So I calculate the conditional probability of I given k. So this is my posterior distribution over the i's. And I weight the final states with those probabilities. And you know, each one of these states is labeled by k, right? I've summed over I, but I haven't summed over k. So this is for every outcome of this measurement, there's a different final state. And the kth final state occurs with a probability which is just trace rho pi k, because rho is now the description of the preparation that comes before the measurement. And so the probability of getting outcome k is just this. Okay, so if you want to work out an expression for this, you just use Bayes' rule. So the probability of I given k is the probability of k given I times the probability of I over the probability of k. And the probability of k given I is just the probability of getting outcome k given that you prepared psi I. So it's just the expectation value of pi k with psi I. So I can now take this expression, plug it in here, and you'll see that this expectation value is now in the numerator and the denominator, so they cancel. And this p of k here in the denominator is just trace rho pi k. So I can rewrite it like this. So this is now a trace. That's wrong. That should just be trace rho pi k. Sorry about that. There should be no bar here. And then finally, I can take the sum over I, p of I, through the pi k, and that's just rho. So it's just this. It's rho projected out and then normalized. So that's maybe what you might have expected. I mean, it's sort of a nice analog of the case for pure states, but we had to do that to recognize there's that trick with the conditional probabilities to see it. So this is the overall collapse map for a projective measurement when we have a density operator as the input. And now the question is, what's the map associated with this whole box where I don't look at the outcome? Any ideas what that would be? Yes?
Sum over that those probabilities?
Yes, exactly. So one way to think about it is that what you prepare when you put a row into that measurement is an ensemble of states, right? So these probabilities for these states. But you don't know which of the states is coming out the box because you haven't looked at it. So we need to find the average density operator associated with this ensemble. And that's just summing these states with these weights. And so the final state is just this. But because the p of k's are trace rho pi k, they cancel, and it's just this. So that is another form of a deterministic transformation. Right, so there's only one possible outcome for every given, one possible output for every given input. In that sense, it's deterministic. And it's certainly not a unitary. So those are the three examples. Now let's take a slightly different approach to the problem and ask for an intrinsic characterization of these maps. So what should we demand of these maps? So I've given you some examples. There's a question of, you know, is this the most general sort of thing? So what we should do is figure out what kinds of properties do we want these maps to have. And then we can answer the question of whether those ones I've described exhaust the possibilities. So what are the properties that an arbitrary transformation should have? So I'm looking for the mathematical characterization of it. So, you know, what kind of map ought it to be?
Map something from an Hilbert space to another Hilbert space, or it might be the same one.
Yeah, let's say it's the same one. So it's actually, what I want it to be is a map from the operators on Hilbert space to the operators on Hilbert space, because I'm applying it to density operators rather than to Hilbert space vectors. So yeah, it's a map from operators in Hilbert space to operators in Hilbert space. Yes?
Should be a semigroup with respect to composition.
A semigroup with respect to composition. That's true. Yes, it should be. Because not all of them are going to be invertible. That's why it's not a group. But it should be a semigroup, because I can always take one transformation, follow it by another, and the overall effect of that is a valid transformation. Yes?
Sorry,
go ahead.
Positive map.
Positive map. What do you mean by that? That's right. It has to map a density matrix to a density matrix. So it maps positive operators to positive operators. So that property, you can think of it as the property of preserving positivity. But it so happens that the mathematicians call that property positivity. So, you know, although, you know, it makes sense to call it positivity preservingness, it's called positivity. So you're right, the map ought to be positive, and what that means is it ought to preserve positivity. So that's another key property. But there's something else that follows from the fact that it maps density operators to density operators.
Preserve the trace.
It should preserve the trace, exactly. Good. And then there's one other property we haven't talked, you haven't mentioned, which is that it should be convex linear, which means that if I take a convex combination of input states, then the output should be the same convex combination of the map acting on each of the input states. And that makes sense because these probabilities describe my ignorance. So, you know, really there's some rho I, and then the map gets applied to rho I, and the final state is going to be T of rho of I. And I just don't know which final state it is. So clearly my, you know, ignorance of the initial state should not affect the nature of the dynamics. So I should describe the final state as just a mixture of the evolutes of each of the initial states. So it turns out that this property, convex linearity, together with the property of preserving trace, so in particular, if the input is a density operator and has trace 1, then the output ought to be a density operator and therefore have trace 1. And there's something that has to be said in addition to positivity. So there's one subtlety here, is that certainly we do need it to be positive, right? So if I put in a density operator, which is a positive operator, then what comes out has to be a positive operator as well. And as I mentioned, you know, this would be better named positivity preserving. But in addition to that, we want it to be completely positive. And what it means to be completely positive is that if I act my map on a system S, when system S is correlated with system A, so the composite of S and A is described by some state rho, and that state might not be a product state. It might be entangled, for example. So when I do my map T on S, and I do nothing on A, so this I just represents the identity map, do nothing, it should be that what comes out is also positive. Because I can always apply my map if I want to a system which is entangled with some other system. And if this final state were not positive, if it had some negative eigenvalues, that would mean that my map would take some valid state of the composite to some invalid state of the composite. So the map would clearly be not physical. So you have to demand that T is completely positive in this sense. Yes?
Unit to map a unit trace to a unit trace. I mean, couldn't it map any trace to a unit? Because you would never put it in, but that's not a property. Like, you would never put something's trace to into the map,
right,
but that's not a property
right
of the map. So you can take everything to be.
So if I take an operator that has trace given by some scalar S, then I can always just write that as S times some operator that has trace 1. And then I could just pull the S outside the trace, and because I know that the final state is going to, if T acting on the bit that's trace 1 has trace 1, then the final trace of the final state will be S.
Okay.
So if this property holds,
that's
then
enough.
It just preserves trace regardless of what the trace is. Other questions? Yes?
It's not kind of clear to me that the completely positive Why are we worried about stuff like that? I mean, does this actually happen if we don't impose that? If you just take the first part of number 3,
yep,
then there would be cases where, for an entangled state, it won't be positive.
That's right. So there are maps which are positive,
but not
completely positive. So this is a tough question. Can anyone think of a map which is positive but not completely positive? If any of you have done some quantum information, maybe you happen to know the answer. And if some of you are clever, you might be able to come up with it. I'm sure you're all clever, but if you're... I just thought I'd throw it out there. Because, you know, it's an opportunity for you to show off by coming up with the answer quickly. So an example is the trace. Not the trace. The transpose. So the matrix transpose operation is one that if I apply it to a positive operator, if I take the transpose of a positive operator, it's still a positive operator. But if I look at an entangled state, so for example, if I take the state 0, 0 plus 1, 1, okay, and I write this as a matrix in the basis 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, then it looks like this. So it has two diagonal terms. Okay, hang on. It's like this. So these terms correspond to the 0, 0 outer product with itself. This is 1, 1 outer product with itself. This is the 1, 1 outer product with 0, 0. And similarly, this is the 0, 0 outer product with 1, 1. So this is the matrix representation of the state. I take the partial transpose, so the transpose on just one of the systems corresponds to basically transposing blocks. And so the transpose gives me 1, 0, 0, 0. Now this block moves over here, 0, 1, 0, 0. This block moves down here. And I can find the eigenvalues of this matrix, and one of them is negative. And so it means that if I take, if I apply the transpose operation on this system alone, what comes out the other side is something that's negative. And so you say that's not a physical operation because I could always, you know, apply it to one half of an entangled system, and I need to have something positive coming out. I can't suddenly be predicting negative probabilities; it would make no sense. If you ask what's the physical interpretation of the transpose operation, it's time reversal. So what it says is you can't reverse the time on one system and leave the time running the same on another system. I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but if you could do that in any sense, it would give you negative probabilities. Other questions? Yes. You're saying you're asking what's the definition of the partial transpose? So if you're talking about, if maybe it's easy to write it in terms of if I have a matrix, you know, like this, then you know, in the regular transpose, I would just change the labels, right? So A mu nu would go to A nu mu, or you know, if I have a 2x2. Then I would go A, B, C, D, like that.
That's not what I was saying. You were saying something. You were saying, like, reversing the time on one and putting on the other, right?
Yes.
But you're taking the other graph of two transformations and then transposing the whole thing. So
no, what you're doing is you're saying, I can think of the transpose operation as a particular choice of script T. It's a map from operators on Hilbert space to operators on Hilbert space. So I can take the map, which is transpose tensor identity. And if I apply that map to this matrix, which is on a 2x2 dimensional Hilbert space, I get this matrix. The transpose, the normal transpose, would be to kind of reflect this about the diagonal. And I'm not taking that. I'm reflecting it blockwise across the diagonal, which corresponds to just doing the transpose on one of the systems. So is that clear now? Yeah? Okay, incidentally, this transpose is really useful as a test for entanglement. So if you read about entanglement theory, you can take a bipartite quantum state. If you take the partial transpose of one half and you find that the thing you've got has negative eigenvalues, that shows that it must be entangled. And it gets more complicated as you go to larger dimensional systems. So if you have just two qubits, the negativity of the partial transpose is a necessary and sufficient condition for entanglement. But if you go to an N cross M, it turns out that there are many other maps that are positive but not completely positive. And you've got to start looking at those other maps as well to find a test for entanglement. OK, so we've characterized these things intrinsically. As an aside, there's a nice way of representing them mathematically. So this is another thing that Ben talked a bit about. If you all maps that satisfy those assumptions we wrote down can be written as follows. Sum over k, ak rho, ak dagger, where the ak are just any linear operators. They don't need to be Hermitian even. And they have to satisfy this identity in order for the map to be trace preserving. So this is called the operator sum, or sometimes the Krauss decomposition of that map. And it's extremely useful in quantum information theory to have that representation. And let me just point out how the different examples of these maps we saw can be put in that form. So the one where we just ignored the outcome of a measurement, that just had this form. So clearly, it's like that, where AK is just a projector. What about this one? How does this fit that form? Yeah, you just have root PI UI as your A. And now here's the tricky one. How do you see that this is of that form? Well, I won't do it in the completely general case. Let me do it in the case where tau happens to be a pure state. So it's just a projector onto a state phi, which I've written over here. Then because the outer product of phi A with itself, you know, that commutes with any operator on S, I can move it to the left and the right, and I can write it in this nice form. So here I'm writing the trace explicitly, sum over J, sum complete basis. That J on the left and on the right. And this object here now is, I have a unitary on S and A, and I'm taking an expectation value with respect to A. So what I'm left with is an operator on S. So this guy is an operator on S, and this guy is just the dagger of that same operator. So again, it has this form. And if tau had a sum, it was a sum of terms, it would just add extra terms to this decomposition. So they all have that nice form. The other fact, which is really important, is can you always implement every map? The question is, can you always implement a map that has those properties, convex linearity, complete positivity, and being trace preserving? And it turns out there's a very nice theorem that shows you can. You can't always do it as a mixture of unitaries. You can't always do it as a non-selective measurement. But you can always do it by coupling to an environment and ignoring the outcome. So this sort of transformation is sufficiently powerful to generate any one of those maps. And that's known as the Steinspring dilation theorem. So you can think of it as if somebody gives you the map, you can dilate it, you can find a representation of it in terms of a unitary on a larger system and an initial state for the environment. This trick of going to the larger system to represent your map is sometimes referred to as working in the church of the larger Hilbert space. So there are some people who don't like working so much with operator sum representations and CP maps. They always want to quantize the environment and treat the whole thing unitarily. Some people prefer the church of the smaller Hilbert space. Personally, there's even a Facebook group, I think, for the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space. I'm a member. I believe in the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space. I think for a lot of problems, it's more elegant and more insightful to work with the maps. Yes?
Isn't the fact that it's called a church because it's purification?
I think it's a church because it's an ideology. Yeah, but you know, there's no bound on the number of jokes you can make about that. Good. One final point about these maps is, you know, we saw in these other contexts with the density operators and the POVMs that there were sort of many operations, the many experimental procedures you could do that at the end of the day yielded the same density operator, like many mixtures that gave the same density operator, or many ways of implementing the same POVM. So the same thing is true here. A given trace-preserving completely positive map can be implemented in many different ways. So consider the following map. You roll some dice, you know, with equal probability. It's basically a coin flip, fair coin flip. And you either implement the identity transformation or the poly Z, which is just, so this is a qubit input. And the poly Z rotates you about the Z axis by 180 degrees. And you don't keep track of which one of these two was done. So your overall map is just this mixture of whatever the input state was with the rotated input state. So question to you, what would this look like on the block sphere? So you've got a block sphere of quantum states. And the question is, where do each of these quantum states get mapped to under this transformation? Let me draw my sphere better. Right? Okay, so these points here and here are invariant. Good?
If you're pointing in the x direction, you end up pointing the opposite way.
Meaning, so if you rotate by 180 degrees, you end up here. Is that what you mean? Yeah. So you're going to have, so this state is going to evolve to a probabilistic mixture with probability half of whatever it started as and what it ended up as. So what is that mixture? It's this guy here. Right. And the same for the y. So these guys, so I'll draw little arrows. These guys get both mapped to here. These guys both get mapped to here. So that's good. So we have these points. We have, if you think about any state on the circle, actually, it's also going to be mapped to its antipodal point, and they're going to mix to the central point. So everything on this disk gets mapped to the central point. What about the rest of the sphere? Right. If I look at a state on here, if I rotate it by 180 degrees, it goes to the opposite side and they mix to the central point. So basically, this map takes you from the surface of the block sphere to the axis at whatever height you started at. Okay? That's called, in quantum information theory, that's called the dephasing map. You're basically losing all the phase information between the Z spin up and the Z spin down state. And you're moving to states which are incoherent mixtures of Z up and Z down. That's what all the states on this axis are. They just have the form, you know, P 0, 0 plus 1 minus P 1, 1. OK, so given that knowledge of how it works, can you think of another way of implementing the same map?
Would you get the same thing if you measured the spin in the Z direction of black box?
You would. That's exactly right. That's the. There are many other ways of measuring it, but that was actually the example I had in mind. So if you just measure the 0, 1 basis, then this is what the map looks like. You project onto the 0 state, and you project onto the 1 state. So as you know, the general expression was sum over k, pi k, rho pi k. So here there's only two projectors, pi 0 and pi 1. This pi 0 is the projector onto 0, pi 1 is the projector onto the 1. So this is what it looks like. This term in the middle is just a scalar. So let me pull it to the front. This is a scalar. Let me pull it to the front. This is just a mixture of 0 and 1 with these weights. But those weights tell me exactly, you know, where rho is, what height they are on the block sphere. You know. So when I take this weighted combination of 0 and 1, it basically says you're moving to the central axis. Okay, so like POVMs and density operators, there are many different combinations of operations which eventually give you the same thing as a representation. So we have now almost, with one caveat, we have the complete formalism for operational quantum theory. So preparations, transformations, and measurements are now represented by these three sorts of objects. Trace preserving completely positive linear maps are the most general representation of transformation. And the probabilistic rule is just take rho, act T on it, take the trace with EK. That'll give you the probabilities for the outcomes. Remember, way back in the second lecture, I talked about how you can think of a preparation followed by a transformation as another effective preparation. It, you know, meets the criteria of just being a list of instructions of what to do in the lab. And so the transformation just maps you from some rho to a rho prime. Or you could think of it as acting on a measurement. And so it turns out that with the unitaries, you know, those two options basically corresponded to the Schrodinger picture and the Heisenberg picture. Okay, here you have an analog, right? So even if you have a completely positive map rather than a unitary, you can take the adjoint of that map. So the definition of the adjoint of the map is now this is a map on operators, but we can think of those operators as a vector space. And there's an inner product on that vector space, which is just trace AB. So here I'm imagining just Hermitian operators. So this is an inner product between the operators A and B. And so relative to that inner product, I can define, so if E is my map, I can define the adjoint of that map to be that thing which, when I act on A, gives me the same scalar as if I act E on B. And so that means that, you know, using this definition, that trace A, E of B should equal trace E dagger A, B. And so that's my definition of E dagger. So it turns out you can have a kind of Heisenberg picture for these guys. And then if you ask, what's the probability of getting outcome K, it's now trace rho times this new POVM, EK prime, which is T dagger EK. But by virtue of the definition of the dagger, this expression is going to be equal to this expression, because I've moved T from rho onto the EK. And so that's the dagger. So you can also have a kind of Schrodinger and Heisenberg picture for these more general operations. So here's the one thing that I didn't take the time to explain. But in the traditional approach, sometimes a measurement leaves the system. You know, it passes the system on after it's done. And that corresponds to some effective transformation. And so this pair, when you condition on getting a particular outcome K, is also some effective preparation, PK. And in the traditional context, the way you update your density operator is just with the von Neumann projection postulate. You project into the subspace associated with the outcome that you got. So there's a generalization of that, which is basically there for a given outcome K, there's a completely positive linear map, but it's trace non-increasing. So it doesn't have to be trace preserving. Effectively, the trace of TK of rho tells you the probability of getting that outcome K. So for any map that's completely positive and linear and doesn't increase the trace, there is some measurement and an outcome of that measurement where you can update according to that map. And if you've told me that the POVM is given by elements EK, then you get a constraint on what those maps have to look like. The dagger of the map acting on an identity has to be EK. So I haven't explained why that is to you, but it's kind of a similar story to everything we've seen so far. If you sort of look at natural generalizations of projection postulate type update rules, you'll soon find that these kinds of things emerge. And then if you sort of ask, what's the most general such update, it's of this form. So remember the postulates, the textbook postulates of quantum theory. The operationalists said the problem with those postulates was that they involved the notion of a physical system and its physical state, and that was inappropriate. It should be formulated entirely in terms of operational terms, things you do in the lab. So here is the new set of postulates with that language eliminated, the realist language eliminated. So it says every preparation is associated with a density operator. That's true. We've shown that. That, you know, the most general thing you can do in the lab is associated with a density operator. Every measurement is associated with a positive operator valued measure. And the probability of some measurement m giving the outcome k is just given by this formula, trace of rho, the thing associated with the preparation, times ek. Every transformation is associated with a trace-preserving completely positive linear map. That's what we just talked about today. And this is the thing that we didn't really have time to go into, but if you get a measurement outcome k, then it's associated with some trace non-increasing CP map and states update according to this rule. So this is what an operationalist would consider to be an improvement over the textbook axioms. And what's nice about this way of thinking about quantum theory, so you could say this is sort of a minimal statement about what the content of quantum theory is. What's nice about it is that you can still be a realist. You can say, I think that quantum states mean something more. But at the very least, you know, I have to reproduce this. This is true. If I go to the lab and I do certain preparations and measurements and I ask, how should I compute the probabilities of outcomes, this formalism works. And so what's nice about it is that it's something that you can aim for. In any interpretational program, you could say, I should at least reproduce this formulation of quantum theory at the end of the day. Questions about that? Good? All right. We started a bit late, so I'm going to sort of move beyond the half-hour point and say a few things about axiomatization. So another nice thing about having that operational framework is that it's not only a target for somebody who wants a realist interpretation, it's also a nice target for an axiomatization. You can say what I want is a set of axioms such that what I can derive at the end of the day are these facts. Okay, so roughly speaking, this is just a cartoon. You know, we have a landscape of possible theories, you know, ways in which kinds of statistics we could get when we do preparations and measurements. You know, you can think of it, if I go to my lab and I do every preparation I can conceive of and a whole bunch of measurements, and I put them all on a big table, there'll be a certain pattern there, a certain structure, the kinds of probabilities I can achieve. And quantum theory is one particular pattern. And the question is, what sorts of principles could pick out those kinds of statistics from among all the possibilities? And you know, the things that are written here are just various strategies people are taking in the axiomatic program. Okay, so I'm going to follow Lucien's 2001 paper. He'll tell you more about that work tomorrow. So I'm just going to give you some preliminary thoughts about it. So I'm going to ignore the transformations for now, just to make life simple. You could talk about the general way of representing transformations, but let me just stick with preparations and measurements. So the question you can ask is, what's a mathematical framework that's generic enough to describe not just quantum theory, but any conceivable theory that has certain minimal consistency properties? So I want a framework that'll allow me to just predict the probabilities of outcomes and measurements. That's all it has to do. It only has to be an operational theory. So here's an approach you can take. Consider all the measurements that you have in your lab, M1, M2, M3. So measurement M1 has two outcomes. Measurement M2 has three outcomes, and so on. And write down a vector, which is the probability of, which gives me the probabilities of the outcomes for each measurement for the preparation P. So this vector is a characterization of the preparation P. It's sort of a very uneconomical but complete characterization of P. It just says, here's a list of the probabilities you'll get for every possible measurement you could do after P. And that's certainly a total characterization of that preparation. So that's one way you could choose to represent a preparation, just the vector of probabilities. And then the measurements would have a very trivial representation. You know, if you want to know what's the probability of getting outcome K for measurement M, well, I could just take the inner product between this vector and a vector that's zero everywhere except for the kth outcome of the measurement I'm interested in. And then that inner product would just return the probability of outcome K for that measurement. So So this is a, as I said, a very uneconomical framework for describing, you know, what you're seeing in the lab or what you're postulating of your given operational theory. But you can do a bit better than this. You can say, try to find a set of fiducial measurements. So the definition of a fiducial set of measurements is a set of two outcome measurements. So I'm thinking of these as just pass-fail measurements. You know, you either pass or you fail. And I can take any measurement, and I can coarse grain its outcomes into two sets and think of it as a pass-fail measurement. So imagine that you have k different pass-fail measurements. And knowing the probabilities for the outcomes of those measurements are sufficient to predict the probabilities for the outcome of any other measurement. Okay, so it's a set of measurements where, you know, if you've done all these measurements and found their probabilities, then you can infer what the statistics for any other measurement would be. You don't have to go and do those other measurements. So it's conceivable that a theory would have this kind of economy, that, you know, you wouldn't have to keep writing down what the statistics of every conceivable measurement is, because at some point you've specified enough. You've got enough information about your preparation that you don't need to do any more measurements. You can predict what the statistics of those other measurements would be. That's certainly true of quantum theory, that you can find, for example, you know, if I think of a qubit, if I do a measurement, say, along the z-axis, and I calculate statistics for a long time, so what I'm imagining actually is I have a source of a particular quantum state rho, meaning I have lots and lots of copies of rho. And so on a large subset of those, I measure z on all of them. And so I get a particular expectation value of z, which tells me that rho must lie in this plane here. And then for another set of copies, I do a measurement of x. And after that's done, I find a particular expectation value, say, here. And that tells me now that I must be somewhere along this line. And then finally, I do a measurement of y. And that tells me where I am along this axis. And I can localize my state rho completely. So those three measurements would allow me to figure out where rho was. And I wouldn't need to then go do more measurements on some other spin axes. Those three measurements would be enough. So those three measurements would be a fiducial set in this sense. OK, so you can now represent your preparation by just giving the probability of passing each of the fiducial tests. This is sometimes called the operational state. It's the thing that allows you to predict the probabilities of the outcomes of any measurement, by definition of what a fiducial measurement is. And so now I could write the probabilities of outcomes of any measurement as some function over the SP, because by assumption, SP has all the information I need. So there's some function that'll do that for me. And then the question is, you know, what can we say about F generically? You know, we're describing a broad class of theories here. Pretty much anything goes. So what constraints are there on F? Well, you know, as we've been doing throughout this week, it's useful to think about mixtures. So suppose you have two preparations, P and P prime, and you weight them with probability W and 1 minus W. So you're going to actually do one of these preparations and pass the system out of this box. And it'll be the first with probability W, the second with probability 1 minus W. That whole thing inside a black box is another preparation procedure. It's perfectly valid. It's a list of instructions what to do in the lab. So the idea is that any operational theory you're willing to consider should be, you know, closed under mixtures. You know, there should be no reason why you can't do this preparation P double prime. You know, you should have. But all we're assuming is that, you know, you've got a way of generating probabilities and choosing from among alternatives. A lot of theories have that sort of structure. So if you grant that, and you ask, what should I say about the probabilities of outcomes of some later measurement when I do this procedure P double prime? Right? So I'm imagining there's some measurement after this guy. Well, it's just, you know, what are the probabilities of the outcomes given that if P were performed, weighted by the probability that P was in fact performed, plus the probability for those outcomes given that P prime was performed, given the probability P prime is performed. So that should give me the probability of getting outcome k given this preparation. So just classical probability theory. And so this function that we were talking about, which you know maps the operational state to the probability for outcome k, should have this form. It should, I've just rewritten this equation in terms of that map. And then I make one other observation, which is that if I think about one of those fiducial measurements, right, one of the special ones, it just is picking out a particular component of S, right? It's just asking, you know, what's the probability for the pass in the first fiducial measurement? So because the fiducial measurements are perfectly valid M, and you know this should be true for all M, then this formula should hold true for each of the components of S. So the fiducial measurements are associative functions that just pick out one given component. Therefore, if this formula is true for each component, it's true for the whole vector. So I also have this identity. And so one thing I can conclude from that is that these vectors, which I'm using to represent the preparation, they form a convex set. Because if I have any two vectors, and I say there are preparations that are represented by these two vectors, then there's a third preparation, which is a mixture of those two guys. So if for any two points, I always have the points that lie between them, I have all convex combinations of them, then it means that the overall set is going to be convex. There's going to be no, it's going to be convex. Let me just say that. So immediately I have a nice non-trivial consequence now, which is that this particular representation I've written down in terms of vectors is going to be a convex set. It has some structure. And furthermore, if I plug this equation into here, it tells me that it gives me a non-trivial constraint on the function f. It has to be convex linear. If I evaluate f on a convex combination of vectors, I get the same convex combination of the images of those vectors. Okay, I'm running out of time, so I only have a couple of slides to go. What you can prove without too much difficulty is that if a function is convex linear, this is just the definition of convex linear, then it's also linear. And you can find this in the first appendix of Leucin's paper. I'm going to skip over the proof, but it's not too hard. It just basically involves sort of starting here, taking the terms, so these are now real coefficients, taking the terms that have negative coefficients, moving them to the left-hand side of the equation, so now they're positive on the left-hand side, and then arguing that this set of positive coefficients can be normalized in such a way that it forms a probability distribution. So then you get an equation where on both sides of the equation you've really got a sum of positive weights that sum to identity, and then you use your convex linearity. Okay, but in any case, you can prove this, and then you make use of this fact from algebra that any linear function over a vector space is just represented by an inner product, right? So if I have some f of s that's linear, then there's some vector in my vector space which represents that function as just r dot s. Good, so what it means is that my probability rule, which was just some function on those operational states, is an inner product function. So every measurement and every outcome thereof should be represented by some other vector in that vector space, which I'll write as r sub m comma k. And the inner product of that vector with the vector representing the preparation gives the probability of the outcomes. So this is the framework. It says your operational states, your representations of preparations, form a convex set. I haven't talked explicitly about it, but you can talk about the shape of the space of these vectors. And it's the interval of something called a positive cone. And you know that the probability rule has to be this inner product. So that's nice, because we've put hardly anything into this theory. You know, we've just said things like, you know, you should be able to convexly combine preparations. That's a very weak assumption. And we have this set, this formalism to describe it. And now note that the shapes of these convex sets are really characterizing your theory. So if you want to imagine a space, a landscape of possible theories, you can start imagining different shapes, different kinds of convex sets. And for each different convex set, you're going to get some different predictions. So this is now a way of thinking about that landscape of theories. Say you take classical theory, operational classical theories. In that case, your vectors S are probability distributions, and the set of such things is a simplex. So suppose you just had, you know, a sample space that had three elements in it. Then the sorts of preparations you could do would be any probability distribution over those three elements. The extremal points are the ones that assign probability 1 to one of them and zeros to the others. And the mixtures of these guys is just the triangle. And so the triangle is a simplex in two dimensions. If I had a sample space of 4, I would get a tetrahedron. The defining property of a simplex is a given point in it has a unique decomposition into the extremal points. So that's the convex set that characterizes a classical theory. The R vectors, which I combine with the S vectors to give me the probabilities of outcomes, are vectors of conditional probabilities. So in a classical theory, I can do a measurement, and the probability of getting the pass outcome for that measurement is just the sum of the probabilities of getting the pass outcome given that the state was 1, and the probability of getting the pass outcome given the state was 2, and so on. So if I take the inner product of this with those probabilities, I'll get the overall probability of passing. And this is what the extremal points in that space looks like. You know, this one here is the case where you only pass the test if the state is 3. This one here is you pass the test if the state is 1 or 3. And so the shape is the unit hypercube. So again, you have a geometric picture now of what the content of classical theories are. For quantum theories, the vector space is just the vector space we keep talking about. It's the Euclidean vector space of Hermitian operators on the Hilbert space. So it's of dimension d squared if the Hilbert space is of dimension d. And the vectors correspond to the trace 1 positive operators. And for a two-dimensional system, that's just our, you know, old friend, the block ball. Pure states on the surface, mixed states in the middle. Doesn't look at all like a simplex. It's a different theory. So in this language, the reason quantum theory is not the same as classical theory is because of the difference in this shape. It's still a convex set, though. And you can work out what the shape of the space of operators are. It's hard to represent because it's in a four-dimensional space. If my space had just been this disk, then this is a sort of a double cone, is roughly speaking what the space of the R vectors would look like. But let me not go into that. So anyhow, this is just a sort of an overview of what those two theories look like in this framework. And I'm pretty much out of time. So maybe I'll let Lucien talk about this. I was going to do sort of one little derivation of the Born rule. But maybe you can ask me afterwards if you're interested. I'll just skip it. Let me just give you the punchline that using this generic framework and the knowledge that the probability rule is always this inner product, and the fact that for quantum mechanics, that inner product, the vectors are Hermitian operators, and the inner product is just trace AB, you can derive the Born rule, right? The Born rule is trace of rho times the operators associated with measurements. So if you know that your statistical rule has to be an inner product between the vectors representing the measurements and the vectors representing the states, then you immediately get the Born rule, the form of the Born rule. And then you can argue that if you grant the structure of the preparations, then you can get the structure of the measurements. So there's this tight connection. You can't independently specify what the preparations and the measurements are. There's a connection between them. So I'll stop there. Yes?
About the simplest thing.
Yes?
You said they're just the convex combinations of the extremal points, but the convex combination is just any coefficient between 0 and 1 times the extremal points.
Yes?
Then why did we get
Well, if so, let me draw my triangle, simplex. So the key is that I have.
I think I've got my definition.
The key is that the weights have to sum to 1. So if I have a certain height here, then I have to have less height along these guys. And when I sum up these three, it never emerges in point.
So,
yes?
So,
So what we have done here is that by starting from a very simple axiom assumption,
yes.
Hardy's assumption, we have derived the Born rule.
I didn't really go into this in detail, but I was actually starting with quite a powerful assumption, which is suppose that your space of states is the Bloch sphere, for example. So, you know, it's not a very good axiomatization because, you know, you really want to know why is it the Bloch sphere.
Right.
But say I just gave you that. Then it would follow that, you know, your vectors that represent the preparations are these trace one positive operators. They live in a vector space of Hermitian operators. And then I know that the rule for calculating probabilities has to be a trace between rho, my density operator, and some other Hermitian operator. And then I ask, what are the properties that Hermitian operator has to have? And I can derive that it has to be positive, and they have to sum to identity, and so they're POVMs.
So suppose I have an n-dimensional Hilbert space,
yes,
and I give what that space is. It's not a Bloch sphere, some higher dimensional generalization of the Bloch sphere. Then in principle, one should be able to derive the Born rule from that?
I'm not quite following you. Maybe we should stop and you can ask me afterwards. So yeah, tomorrow is Lucian's going to chat with you, and then I'll see you again on Monday.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too.